Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to another edition in our series that we've titled Perspectives on Inclusion and Belonging. Today we welcome Afsani Beshlas, who has been named one of the most powerful women in finance many times over on many different lists, is a longtime friend to Bridgewater and is CEO of that she founded many years ago, Rock Creek Investments. And she's here to talk to us today about her incredible journey through the World Bank, through Carlyle, through founding her own firm, and for her entire journey that we can learn from. So today we welcome Afsani Beshlas, and we're so glad that you're here.
So wonderful to be with you, Robin, and so honored to be with such a great group and friends at Bridgewater.
And so we're going to cover a lot of aspects of your life and career today. And well, something we say a lot at Bridgewater is we like to go back before we go forward. So if you could start with telling us about your childhood in Iran and how that shaped who you are today.
So Robin, I think being an immigrant, you don't realize how important it is until you get to be a little older. But certainly living in Iran, which was very different time, different place. When I grew up, it was very open. Women could basically aspire to anything. Difficult to imagine that at this very moment. And also growing up in a family that was incredibly supportive and valued education, valued doing your best, and had really incredible values sort of drawn into us as very young to me and my sisters. And then my family was also very supportive when I decided at age 16 to come to the US for the first time as an exchange student. Not an easy feat, but I arrived in Concord, Mass, very young, and having gone to the international school, you know, language was not a barrier, but certainly living in Massachusetts, which was equally cold to Tehran, by the way, and where you could ski and you could, you know, do similar things, but otherwise the similarity stopped right there. Was very different. I also lived with a family that was an academic family, similar to my own. My father had been president of the university, and I lived with a family that, you know, where the husband taught at MIT, and I lived in a community in Concord, Mass, that had a lot of Harvard and MIT people, and you know, it was just incredible experience, and so many coincidences that lead to the future. And one of them, I should mention, we lived across from Bob Solow, who is a Pulitzer winning, Nobel Prize winner economist. And you know, at that point, I did not go to study economics in university, but certainly a great person to know when you're a 16-year-old.
Yes, that's fascinating. And then you went to building on those that background, you then went to Oxford, is that right?
Absolutely. I did my economics degree in Canterbury, then at Oxford, and at Oxford I did my postgraduate studies. Again, you know, you talk about coincidences in life. As I was studying economics, there were a few great professors at that time at Oxford. One was Joe Stiglitz, who I think was off, I forget, from Princeton or wherever he was teaching. And during the time I was doing my master's degree, he was at Oxford. So he was a great professor to have at that time. Amartya Sen, who has written a lot about famines and the distribution of food and poverty, very relevant to today's problems. And really everything he wrote then is very applicable to today. And then other influences, one of my professors and tutors was somebody called Robert Mabro, sadly has passed, but he started something called the Energy Institute at Oxford. And I became kind of his assistant, helping him with logistics and running it, and got to start meeting people who were running very big energy businesses, Exxon, BP, as well as OPEC leaders who used to come to Oxford once or twice a year for events. And another great influence.
And energy itself had been a big part of your career as an investor also. So has that been a theme throughout?
Robin, it's kind of, again, interesting because Robert Mabro, the professor I mentioned at Oxford, had this conversation with me. I was saying, you know, I'm trying to figure out, I'm really interested in energy, but I'm not sure which area to concentrate on. And this is quite a few years ago. I'm not going to tell you how many years ago. It gives away too much sensitive information. But he said, learn about natural gas. It's a cleaner fuel than oil, not perfect, but cleaner. And very few people know about it. And all the men know about oil, you'll know all about natural gas. So that's how I ended up doing natural gas. And then I went to JP Morgan, which was my first job out of Oxford. And one of the people who had been working, who'd been also at Oxford with me doing his doctorate thesis at the time happened to be working in the same group. And he also had a strong energy background. So we did a lot of early M&A work in energy at JP Morgan, totally coincidental again. But all these things that in life you don't think are connected that do get connected. And then I, even, you know, while I was at the Oxford and JP Morgan, I was very mission driven. So I wanted to do something that would influence the world and make the world a better place, which sort of sounds a little too much to say, but I did decide to leave JP Morgan and go to the World Bank. And again, there, I was very fortunate. The energy area in the bank was booming. We were investing not just in hydrocarbons, but very early into renewable energy at a time where renewable energy was not so popular. And one of my first bosses at the World Bank happened to be a woman, somebody called Diane Julius. She's now Dame Julius, and she happens to be on my advisory board at Rock Creek and a great mentor all through since World Bank days. But also somebody who really helped me to think broadly. And her big tenets were, make sure you always do the right thing, work with the right people, work with people who are ethical, not just, you know, what you do, but who you work with is really, really important.
I want to go backwards a bit to the decision to go to JP Morgan in the first place and leave academia. Could you tell us a little bit about what you were weighing there when you did that?
So Robin, I was, I finished my master's degree. I was doing my doctorate thesis at Oxford and at the same time teaching economic development and international trade. And the revolution in Iran had made it clear that it was not easy to go back and, you know, be a professor there. And then I had two job offers then. One was to go teach at Vassar and the other one was to go to JP Morgan. And I thought, okay, I might end up in academia later on in my life somewhere, but why don't I try learning about how markets work, how a bank operates. And this was sort of the, JP Morgan at that point provided us with a 9-month training program. Nobody does that anymore. No one invests in you in that way. Very fortunate because economics had been very theoretical in England. And it was the first time I did courses in corporate finance and accounting. And so it was really, really amazing experience. And you learn that your economics training is very useful, but it is really important to understand how the real world works. And JP Morgan in that training program would have professors come and train you in the morning. Then they would have practitioners come and tell you actually what they were doing in JP Morgan. So it was unbelievable experience. A lot of friendships then who are close friends today.
And at the World Bank, I'd love to hear, you spent a lot of your career there, and I'd love to hear the version of your what it was like to work there.
So I had sort of, if you want to divide it up, two careers at the World Bank. One was the energy area, and as I mentioned, I started as a young person there, and thanks to Diane Julius and many others who were very supportive, I got to eventually lead the energy business at the World Bank, which was also I also was doing a lot in solar, wind and other renewable energy really early, both policy and investments, and started a natural gas group there, which in a lot of those natural gas teams still are there. Then I went and spent a little time at Shell at the group planning where they do scenarios, which was really interesting because it connected, again, the real world. And as I was coming back, I talked to a friend of mine at the bank who was on the trading floor of the World Bank. And he said, why don't you come on the trading floor and you can be sort of our economy strategist and learn to trade? And I said, I've never traded before. I worked on markets, but never traded before and done portfolio management. And what if I'm bad at it? He said, well, if you're bad at it, you learn. If you're bad at it, you just go back to what you're doing. So anyways, that was good advice. So I jumped onto the trading floor and we did a lot in fixed income. The World Bank trading desk was very sophisticated at that time. And then I went to work for the person who really ran the bank, and I became their special assistant and worked with somebody called Ernie Stern, who essentially was running the bank and the finances of the bank. We're starting to think about the new sort of hedge fundy type structure. And World Bank had been, through its pension fund, investing in early hedge funds, had been early investors in hedge funds, but also on the trading desk where I was trading, we were doing relative value trading without the kind of high leverage that you would do, you know, you do today, or, you know, other hedge funds do. And at the bank we managed, you know, I think it was more than 100 billion, not just for the World Bank, but also for clients of the World Bank.
I wanted to turn next to your decision to go to Carlyle. You were one of the early partners, one of the early partners in the whole organization at a time when there weren't even many women at all in the industry. I'd love to hear about your decision to do that, and then also about what it was like, and what were those rooms were like, what those decision making choices were like.
So again, that ended up being sort of almost, I don't want to say coincidence, but it was not a plan. I was very happy at the World Bank, loved my job, running, you know, close to 100 billion plus investments at that time was quite big. We were working with a lot of the biggest sovereign funds, by the way, like Norwegians were small then, and we were advising them on asset allocation and such things. And then also being treasurer of the bank, you know, being responsible for all the borrowings of the World Bank, being responsible for the ratings, the finances, the balance sheet, you know, all that good stuff. So making sure we had a AAA rating, which the bank still does, doing sort of early innovations in a lot of the markets, which again, I was very fortunate to be part of, but being really with a cutting edge group of super quant people and super, you know, people who are great lawyers, great quantitative people, great systems people working together and creating new tools to do asset allocation and dynamic asset allocation. So that was super fortunate and I was really loving it. And then a friend of mine who I had known from school was at a different, very big financial institution and approached me to go become chief investment officer there. And I thought to myself, well, if I don't do something, if I don't leave the World Bank, I'll probably never leave the World Bank. I'm enjoying it too much. And so I started thinking and I went to Jim Wolfenson, who was then president of the World Bank. His advice was, why don't you take a year off? I took some time off between parts of my career and went and learned to play the cello. I used to play the piano when I was younger. He said, why don't you go play the piano for a year? Sort of try and think what you want to do with your life. But don't leave the World Bank. Anyways, this sort of coincidence led to other things, and it sort of ended up with me joining Carlyle, which was a great decision. And I'm sure you all know David Rubenstein, who's a great leader, not just in private equity, but as a philanthropist and as a historian and as a human being. And so it was very fortunate to work with what was then called Bill, David, and Dan, who were the three original founders, and I was the 12th partner. So it was really interesting to be in the room when private equity decisions were being made at the same time as I was helping the firm create a new business. And I have to tell you, even though there were not a lot of women around the table, I never felt different or treated any different. And being a woman was as comfortable as being, you know, having any other sexual orientation. So it was a really great experience. I learned a huge amount on so many levels. And so again, there was no plan to start Rock Week, but one thing led to another. And at that point, you may remember that that there was a lot going on in the early 2000s in the market, and doing new things was hard, but you know, I jumped in and started Rock Week.
I want to go to Rock Creek in a second and spend a lot of dive deep into the business model and the work that you're doing there. But one thing I wanted to sort of pull back from and ask, what is your advice for people who are navigating their career after looking back on your own? Like, what is your advice for people looking for the next right thing and how to make a decision to make the moves like you've made? What advice would you give to those people looking for that?
I think, you know, you hear all that stuff about, you know, follow your passion, do the things you're interested in. I really loved energy. I still love energy. I still do a lot of work in energy. I really love finance and the interconnection of those two. And now with all the work we do on climate and clean energy is really, really exciting. And, you know, more broadly on impactful investments. But I think you have to, and I was very fortunate because as I was, you know, while I was a doctor, I was working with people who were thinking about these things in early times. When I came to the World Bank, in fact, I got recruited into the World Bank by somebody called Andrew Steer. He happens to be now running World Resources Institute that I'm on his board. He's one of the probably world's most preeminent people in the whole environment and climate areas. You know, and the question then is, when you meet people, try to learn from them and try to, you know, we all have good habits, bad habits, good things we're doing, not so good things we're doing. Try to sort of learn from the people who are around you, whether, you know, some will be more generous, and try to seek the ones who are generous with their time and mentoring to learn more about yourself and what your passions are, and then learn more about the subject area and the technical area, whatever it is. Learn to read the fine print. One of those, you know, minor things we learned at the World Bank early on, read the fine print on whatever it is you're doing, whether you're investing or, you know, on the trading floor doing a trade or whatever. Don't just be at the high level, get down, you know, get your hands dirty. And so that was really excellent advice, because it's not what you do, but who, you know, if that is enjoyable while you're doing it. And I'm sure COVID has made that much more real for us. So I would say, you know, seek what you enjoy doing rather than what you don't enjoy doing, because if you do that, you're going to just put that much more energy in it and be more fulfilled. And very important, work with really good people, really decent people, and people you value and where you share your values. Because again, you might disagree, you might, you know, look at what's been going on the last few weeks, just the last few weeks. And, you know, markets are in so much upheaval. When you work with people where your values are similar, but your views are different, you're going to succeed because you're not, you know, you're going to have disagreements, but you're going to end up with the best decision rather than the worst decision. So I think that was sort of very fortunate. And last but not least, like I said, Deanne Julius was a very big influence. There's another woman who was very important influence on my life. Jessica Einhorn was first treasurer, woman treasurer of the World Bank. And she actually, when I was working in energy and moving to finance, she said, you should move to finance. You have to travel a little less. So if you have a family, you don't have to be gone 3 weeks in Africa or Asia or Latin America. You can go for a few days to, you know, travel. Do you have more control over your travel schedule? So people who sort of thought about things before I could think about them and guided me and mentored me. So work with people who value you and mentor you. So I think all of those things will make a difference in whatever you end up doing. Sorry for this long-winded answer, Robin.
This is great. I'm like, thank goodness we're recording so I don't have to write down all the advice. And because there's so many lessons in there that apply to everybody who's navigating their career. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I'd love to turn to Rock Creek. Can you describe the business model and what mattered at most when you were forming it?
So again, I think what mattered was most was, I remember when I was at the World Bank, one of the things that we really loved doing was the idea of a strategic partnership. So we had a lot of partners, and we were partners with our clients. So at the World Bank, we had built this business where we worked with a lot of sovereign funds and central banks and advised them, helped, you know, the Bank of China build their first trading floor. They didn't have a trading floor, I believe. It's not hard to think about that. So we were going to China early days. So there was working with the Norwegians as the Norwegian Oil Fund was started, but you know, they had just a few people. They were trying to think about how they should allocate their assets and how to invest and create benchmarks and simple things like that. That, you know, now they are the ones who sort of lead the chart in many ways. So we were very fortunate to be on that front, helping to advise, but also working with some of the most sophisticated people in economics, in finance, in technology. We had an incredibly old relationship with Bloomberg, long before my days. Apparently, World Bank was first user of Bloomberg machines. So apparently, again, according to folklore, Michael Bloomberg came and trained the World Bank staff on how to use the first or second Bloomberg machine. So coming from that environment into Rock Creek, the first thing was, how do you create an environment that is very open to new ideas, research-based, but also very focused on what the clients need. And so we started our business creating customized portfolios for our clients. And that could be in alternatives and in private areas, et cetera. So if you look today, fast forward to today, what does Rock Creek do? We have a group of clients who will hire us in one, two, three, often multi-asset class areas, or as their outsourced CIO, where we become their CIO and we allocate across all asset classes. So we have a team that does that. The other part of our business is that we have been, I told you about our long history in ESG. We're very fortunate. So we have some of the leaders really in ESG in Rock Creek. And again, when we started the firm, we were not just thinking strategically ESG is going to be popular. But for example, Ken Lay, who also joined Rock Creek as senior managing director, was also treasurer of the World Bank. He did the first global bond ever. I'm sure David McCormick and others may remember him from then in David's previous career. And Ken did the first green bond at the World Bank before he joined us at Rock Creek. We had, I mentioned Deanne Julius, who was my mentor, who had then moved on to be on the board of BP, chief economist at Shell, and also on the boards of Temasek and CIC and many others, but thinking about these topics and energy in general in a very strategic way. Laura Tyson has been on our board and very thoughtful. She was on the board of SASB, as you know, and a great leader both in inclusion, diversity, and ESG, and she's been on our board since day one. So it has been very fortunate. I won't go through every name, but Caroline Atkinson, Ali Theodore Walla, Sherry Rosoff, Marian Mashiaki. So a lot of people in the firm who have really been working in these areas since day one. So the part of our business that has been, I would say, probably growing the fastest is really working with our clients on creating new products, if you want to call it that, in ESG and sustainability, including Climate Fund, a group of my friends that I work with at the World Bank and IFC and who've moved on to other places are coming together to invest in private climate investments. But you know, people with 25 plus years experience, so it's really exciting. A lot of our clients have asked us to create new products for them in impactful investments. So we've been doing that the last few years, and that has been really, really exciting too.
Right. You had mentioned when we talked before that ESG and diversity and inclusion were core to your approach. And we're doing it before it was the popular thing to do. And part of that's based on your expertise, but it also sounds like it's part of where you think how to create value. And so I wanted to hear a little bit about that as the mission or those as sources of value for your investors.
Sure. So in terms of taking inclusion, pre-COVID, we started adding up and we realized we had invested, by the way, more than 19, close to 20 billion in emerging talent. You know, you and I talked about finding new talent all the time, but also 6.5 billion in diverse firms. And that's just by ownership. As you well know, we have this huge database that covers diversity. And what we see is that diversity, one dimension is ownership, another dimension is management, who are the highest five people paid in a firm, you know, who are the people who are making decisions in different areas. So you have to measure it in different ways. You have to also measure progress. So not only we have invested this huge amount in diversity, which is probably more than most, but also we have done a lot of studies and done white papers with IFC. We did a white paper, and frankly, the results were shocking. We looked at 700 private equity and venture firms, much more data in emerging markets than in the US at the company level, not just the fund level, thanks to IFC. But one, there are more women GPs in emerging markets than in the US. Can you imagine? 20% higher return for gender balanced teams. And those gender balanced teams were much more likely to also invest in entrepreneurs and firms that were likely to have some form of diversity. So these are things that we know anecdotally are true, but this was data over 15 years because IFC requires it, you know, as you talked about, you know, diversity, inclusion, ESG were things that I grew up with, right? Whether I was at Oxford early on, whether I was at the World Bank early on, and now at Rock Creek. So I was very fortunate, as I said, that that I happened to have been in those environments. So going back to this areas on ESG also, we were investing in health early, investing in education early, financial inclusion, housing affordability. And guess what? During COVID, what we realized, even in last March when the markets collapsed and since, what are people investing in? Companies that do long distance learning, companies that do telemedicine, you know, some of the new innovations in health. And those have been areas that we had been fortunate to be investing in, thinking, you know, how can you make a long-term impact? And I mean, I truly believe that looking forward, those will continue to be really, really exciting areas.
And real sources of value, and where companies and investment teams can make a real difference by getting the best ideas. That's great. Thank you.
Absolutely right.
I want to change tactics a little bit on looking at Rock Creek and ask your advice for anyone who's thinking of starting something from scratch the way you did. What are the lessons that you would share or watch out for that you would share in starting something from nothing?
So Robin, first of all, it is great fun to start something from nothing. Two is, while the fun part of it is there, just don't forget, you have to do the A to Z. So whenever we interview anyone at Rock Creek, the first thing we say is that doesn't matter whether you're coming in to do this job or that job. We have, you know, we're very fortunate. We have Alan Greenspan, who is a senior advisor to Rock Creek, who spends a lot. His office is next to mine at Rock Creek, and he is in his 90s. And, you know, he has had an unbelievable career, but he'll get up and go get his own coffee and go back to his office. And so, you know, role models are in all shapes or forms, but learn to do everything and be very hands-on. And there's nothing that is below you. And I think it's easily said, hard to actually do, especially for people who worked in bigger organizations where work is very segmented. And I think if you want to do your own firm, no matter what it is, the connectivity of the different parts of the work, the workflow, and now there are a lot of much better and fancy terms in terms of product management and workflow development with technology. But you really have to understand the connectivity about the other different parts of your business. Two, I have to tell you, Robin, I mean, at the time where I decided to start Rock Creek, I also in the very back of my mind, my kids were younger. I have two sons, and you know, they were very young at that point. I said, I leave, you know, World Bank, Carlisle, I have more time, more freedom to spend with them. That equation was wrong. If you have a startup, your startup becomes kind of like the rest of your family, or you know, whatever is close and highly important to you. And so you have to think of it as different. And I think, you know, it's all consuming 24/7. So those are, you know, the positive and the negative, like everything else goes together.
That's a good segue too into sort of a general life advice question you'd give to working moms. If you could go back in time and tell yourself at the beginning of your career, the lessons that you've learned as a working mom, I know I and many other working moms and working parents would love to hear that too.
Well, I think it's, I don't want to be presumptuous to advise others on being a working mom, but I think there's two things that have, that now looking back, I wish I had done more of. One is all my jobs have involved a lot of travel and being away from home, but I remained, you know, very focused on my family during that time. I also had a very supportive family, sort of bigger new family nucleus, so that was very fortunate. But looking back now, we're all, you know, and especially post-COVID, were all those trips necessary, you know? So I think you just have to be, for moms today, or dads, same thing, you know, you wanna be much more careful. I work with a coach called Marshall Goldsmith, who is really, really thoughtful. And the first thing he'll ask you is, who's going to be around you on your deathbed? It sounds like a morbid question. But actually, you know, what's most important to you, and what do you want to, you know, what matters to you? So don't forget those things. And he did that with me one-on-one, and then he did that with our whole team. But, you know, the answers you get are very different. But just remember what is important and what makes you happy, and really, you know, to the extent possible, do follow your heart and your head at the same time. I think that's one thing. And I think women, you know, as women, because we, unfortunately, it's as hard, I find today, as it was when I started. I don't find, Robin, it's easier today than, you know, 20 years ago or earlier. So for women, and you do still have to be proving yourself. I think there are a lot of people in your firm and in other firms that are trying to make diversity truly possible in a firm, and that are much more family friendly, but it is still difficult, and a lot of pressures end up on women. And we've seen the COVID data, right? So a lot of women are leaving the workplace. And I think that is why it's really, really important. You have to work 3 times harder, but maybe work 1.5 times harder, not 3 times harder.
It's great advice. I know there's so many questions from our audience, but there's one more area I really wanted to cover before we open it up to the floor. Is your philanthropy work. You have always been a champion philanthropist and serve on many nonprofit boards. What work are you drawn to?
Again, I think the areas that I've been most drawn to, I mentioned the climate and energy. So I'm very working closely with World Resources Institute, with National Geographic and others who are, you know, focused on making our planet and where our world where we live a better place for all of us. So that has been exciting, very related to what I've cared about really since I was very young and continuing today at work. And the other area I've always been interested in is health and education. So that's the other area for my, you know, philanthropy work, but also board engagement. And so that would, you know, take me to areas on health and education that again, I'm passionate about. I think I would like to be a doctor maybe in another life. But in the meantime, I think I get a lot of enjoyment and try to contribute in those areas. And the most and today, as we speak, being on the board of GAVI, which is the Global Alliance for Vaccines, is working with COVAX to bring vaccines to the lower income countries. Everything that Gabby has been doing for a long, long time is so relevant to the experience with vaccine distribution that we're all facing in our daily lives. Gavi has come up with such great ways to distribute vaccines to the poorest of the poor in very fragile economies. But that experience is very relevant to the US and Europe and the rest of the world right now.
Very right. I can only imagine thinking about how much work it's been just to get a vaccine appointment for my elderly mother who lives in Pittsburgh, let alone what it's going to be like to do this for our whole country and world. So that makes sense. What advice would you have for a person thinking about how to find their own purpose or be more involved in the nonprofit world and nonprofit boards?
You know, again, getting involved with a nonprofit board, I was working at the World Bank, which is, you know, a giant nonprofit. Even if I worked in areas that had, you know, let's say when I was on the investment area, we were supposed to generate returns. I was issuing bonds for the World Bank. You're supposed to make sure you do that at the lowest cost of the World Bank, et cetera, et cetera. I think the one thing was, again, pure coincidence. When I left at the World Bank, you couldn't really join any boards, for profit or not for profit. But when I left, I joined a board of nonprofit, and I really recommend doing that. It was a real stretch. I mean, I learned so much about and you know, I had worked at the World Bank. Nonetheless, it was a stretch. And then I was on the board of Ford Foundation, which Darren Walker leads now and is probably one of the most thoughtful, leaders in nonprofit and philanthropy work. You know, he's been talking about the issues of race and inequity in our country for a long time. And a lot of things he's been talking about are finally being talked about more openly in society. So I think boards are a stretch. It's hard to do your day job, to take care of your family and do nonprofit and help others. But I think that the enjoyment you get, the satisfaction you get, the learning you get, the contributions you can make are really, really important, I think, to anyone's life.
Thank you. I would like to open it up now to our audience to be able to ask a question. We have a way where I believe Nicole is going to send a person a message and tell them to unmute their microphone. Is that right, Nicole? Shadi is our first.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Great. So hi, first of all, Afsana, thank you so much for your time today. This has been really interesting and I'm just grateful for your insight. It's been great. My name is Shadi. I've been at Bridgewater for many years, including on the client service side and now on the services side. But I have a general question for you. I read in one of Shirin Ebadi's like really amazing books about how in the 80s and 90s, she kind of looked around and so many of her friends and colleagues had left Iran. And she found she resented them for it and for not staying behind and doing something to help the country and to help its people. It's something I've always thought about. My family came here when I was 5, so I didn't have much of a vote in the matter. But as an Iranian American, or generally as people, is there anything we can do to help the people of that country from the outside in? I think about that all the time.
Shadi, it's nice to meet you, and what a really fascinating question. I think, so many different levels. I think I was very fortunate about the time I lived in Iran, but let's just not forget that the culture in Iran is very powerful. It goes back to Zoroastrian days and education is highly valued. Let me give you the example. For example, today, we had a summer intern who joined Rock Week last summer. By the way, Robin, we have had 350 interns join Rock Week, 80% diversity. So in that group, and they've been great. We have hired a number of them and they've been wonderful. But this particular intern was, we recruited from Stanford and we were looking for certain attributes. And she happened to have come from Iran, undergraduate. She was in her second or third year. And she was a physics Olympiad. So physics Olympiad in Iran today, given everything we're reading, had got into Stanford and she was working with us as a summer intern. So even today for women, because of this value of education, I think culturally, it is better than in many other parts of the, you know, emerging market, I would broadly sort of say. There are more women there doing STEM than in many other places. I was shocked. She told us the stories that were shocking in terms of, you know, the positive. I'm not, you know, talking about, there's lots of negatives that we all know. So I think you can certainly, you know, I'm not sure if I agree with the idea that you have to sit and, you know, you have to be in a particular country. I actually chose the opposite. I went and worked at the World Bank because I felt that I could contribute to more women and more, you know, people who were living in poverty all over the world, not just the country that I happen to have been born in. And so you can choose your way. You can't say this is right or that is wrong. I think so long as you are helping people who are poor in your community, in your, you know, in the wider world that you are coming across, I think you're doing your job. And I'm still hopeful that thanks to education and thanks to these kinds of women that I have met, maybe there is hope for the future.
Thank you so much. I'm hopeful too and optimistic.
Thank you, Shadi. Emily O'Connor, let me turn to you next.
Hi, well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning. My question is actually on your thoughts on sustainable investing. And while you mentioned that there is an increased interest in ESG investing, which is great to see, I'm curious to hear what you think are sort of the largest challenges in getting more investors on board with ESG and sustainable investing.
So, Emily, I think in the last, I would say, pre-COVID, even up to a year ago, there was a lot of, there were people who were interested and there were people who were basically the word ESG or the word impactful investments. And by the way, the word diversity would imply sort of maybe not as high returns or as good returns. That changed a lot, I think, post-COVID. So my sense is that a lot more people are now, when we talk to investors, the boards I'm involved with, pretty much the exception now will be people who are not interested in investing because they see the returns. And one of the efforts we're doing at Rock Creek right now, at Rock Impact, which is this sort of area we've created where we're putting all our data and we're going to take it out of Rock Creek, make it available to a bigger group of people, to everyone really, is we have gathered data for the last 20 years, which does prove that diversity and impactful investments have as good returns as anything else. They don't have to be higher, they don't have to be lower, but they can be as good. And I think data, which is something that you all work on a lot, will be a really, really important thing in the future to show that you actually can do well. If you know, you invest in impactful investments in the long run, that's good for everyone. But you're absolutely right. That was not the case probably. You know, most investors have been sort of kicking and screaming until recently.
Thank you, Emily. I'd like to turn to Bar Even next.
Hi there. Hi, Afsaneh, and thanks again for being here with us today. My question is also on the hot topic of sustainable investing. Specifically, you know, as you say, people are seeing impact investing as more being returns friendly. Are you guys offering that product or seeing design for that product to be sort of standalone, like carve out, like this is the piece that's for mission? Or are you also, or instead of kind of trying to integrate it into your broader investment process as sort of like risk mitigation, alpha generation? I'm interested in your perspective on that choice.
Bar, I think that's really so important. So we are doing both because we do have some investors who want standalone, you know, parts of their portfolio that are concentrating on impactful or diversity or inclusion. But otherwise, it's included very much and integrated into the way we think and the way we invest. So if you look at any of our investment portfolios, you'll see a lot of these themes. We've been investing in emerging markets for a long time. Obviously, we worked at the World Bank. You know one or two things about emerging markets. So in, let's say, emerging market equities, I've been investing in health for the last 7-8 years, right? And so those themes in ESG have been playing out, and some of our highest returns have come from those. So it is very much integration, I think. I believe, Bart, that as we move forward, I hope it will be much more of an integrated thing, not this sort of separate thing that you do because you heard about it or your board suggested it, or and I think the other thing that is very positive is if you now listen to, let's say, the CEO of Exxon, they're talking about carbon capture. If you listen to the CEO of BP, they're calling themselves not an oil company, but an energy company. If you listen to a lot of companies now, they're talking about net zero. A lot of companies. A year ago, much fewer. So this is not just investors. This is the companies that we all invest in that are moving much faster. And, you know, frankly, the next generation will not buy their stock, whether it's private or public, if they don't think about these things.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I know we're getting close to time, and I am so grateful for you for coming in and sharing your time and your wisdom with us, both on the trends in investing and in our business that we see today. So thank you so much, Afsani, for joining us today. And we're so grateful. And looks like Dave's back. Dave?
I've always been here. I just want to say thank you, too. It was a great, great talk, and just as I knew it would be. So thanks again for spending time with us. I know we all appreciated it.
Thank you so much, David. Great to be with you, and a real honor. And thank you, Robin. And thank you, David.
Thank you so much for this today. And I know our whole community appreciates it.
See you very soon.
Bye-bye. Take care.